Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart. On the show this week...
The leader of a very militant group came to meet, and as they came into the room, they sat down and just said, if someone believes the wrong thing, does their life have any value? And I remember us sort of saying back, well, what do you think? Which seems the safest thing when you're talking to someone who's known for terrorism. And they said, no, if you believe the wrong thing, your life has no value.
Why are we here? Can I have a relationship with God? These kinds of things I can't measure with my microscope or my telescope.
Hope deranges us. Hope breaks things and breaks things down.
Christianity isn't some kind of self-help doctrine. It's not probiotics for the soul or something, you know?
He was using the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify bombing Syria.
One of the most common questions we ask each other when we meet for the first time is, so what do you do? And for some people, the answer is pretty straightforward. I'm a teacher, I'm a hairdresser, I'm an engineer, I'm a taxidermist. Everyone gets it. And for others, it's more complicated. And Michael Ramsden is one of those. Natasha Moore is with me. Natasha, you interviewed him.
Yeah, I got to speak to Michael for close to an hour, and I still can't tell you exactly what it is he does. I think speaker is the closest I could get, but that doesn't tell you all that much. This is a guy who travels around the world speaking at places like the White House, to corporates, to the KGB, to terrorist groups even. We'll get to some of that later. He seems to spend his life having interesting conversations with interesting people.
Yes, he's one of those people who just always seems to be in the right place at the right time. For example, he told you about being invited to speak to Australian MPs on what turned out to be a very eventful day.
Yeah, I don't know if it's right place at the right time or wrong place at the wrong time. He spoke at this parliamentary prayer breakfast in 2015, the same day as one of our all too frequent leadership spills, as we call them. On this occasion, Liberal Prime Minister Tony Abbott got ousted by Malcolm Turnbull. Here's Michael.
I mean, I'll never forget, I was talking there about roughly about love, tolerance and truth. And we struggling as a culture to hold all of those things together. Anyway, as I got up to speak, I think it was the then deputy PM who was sat next to me and various members of the cabinet, and they said, oh, we can't stay. There are some issues going on today. And I said, I have been reading the newspapers. And the leadership challenge had been called to that evening. One of the reasons a lot of people there really had nothing to do with me. I think, you know, they'd all had to come back to vote. And when I finished, someone said, would you like to come back and have dinner with some members of the cabinet? And then when it was announced that we're going to be the leadership challenge that evening, I can remember thinking, well, that dinner's off. And I was actually looking for a restaurant with a colleague of mine that evening in Canberra, only to get a phone call to say, you are coming back. And I think my abiding memory from that was not just simply watching all the people vote in the two houses, standing in the rotunda where you can see through the glass doors and you can see both houses at the same time. But also the fact that there is this huge need for us in our society to figure out how do we deal with our disagreements differently. Otherwise, it's impossible to bring any kind of real unity together, because unity isn't just founded in our core convictions, which are very important, and don't want to belittle those at all, but also in terms of the commitments that we have to each other, in terms of the relationships that we want to sustain. And I think that's what we're struggling with right now. And as a matter of fact, you can step into any political jurisdiction around the world right now, and you can see the outworking of that in a way that isn't potentially the best. But I really did enjoy addressing everybody there, and I really enjoyed the dinner afterwards. Various people were being called out to be lobbied by both of them and then rejoining the dinner. When I left the parliament, actually, I don't know how many reporters were outside. It felt like 500, maybe not that many. And I stepped out with a friend of mine, and we were blinded by flash photography for about 5 seconds. And then all the cameras stopped when everyone realized, who are you? I've got no idea who you are. And I remember I was about 100 yards away or so. And then all of a sudden, out came the leadership to make the announcement about what had happened. And it looked like a thunderstorm behind us. And in many senses, it was. We looked over our shoulder. Because you see this, the light flashing off all of the buildings around us. I enjoyed that trip. I didn't mean to change the government. That happened unintentionally. I did wonder, it took a few years before I got invited back, and I was wondering if there was some nervousness about that. But
there can not, always be another leadership.
It's not
skill.
Always my goal to inflict regime change everywhere I go.
I asked Michael about how you end up being the kind of person who travels the world speaking to everyone from terrorists to Australian MPs. We went back to the beginning, to his quite unusual upbringing, and how religion fit or didn't fit in that picture.
So my mother's from a country called Cyprus, which is in the Mediterranean. My father is from England. I was raised most of my life in the Middle East. So all of my childhood memories come from that part of the world. I don't really remember living anywhere else apart from there, because I was very young when we moved out there. And my father was working in the construction industry then. So I think I grew up thinking I was either neutral on the question of God or unsure in that it seemed to potentially lead to a lot of difficulty in society. And so you have to remember in countries like Saudi Arabia, there's a form of religious observance that's very strictly enforced, and there are all kinds of legal consequences that also flow. I sort of built a slight indifference to it. Does that make sense? So I didn't feel there was no point having an argument if people were simply going to be angry about something. And so the easiest thing was just to stay largely quiet and just let things go by. And so I think by the time my parents moved to Cyprus, partly because of my mother's health conditions, I met some Christians who were different, certainly different from ones I'd met previously. Previous Christians I met, I would say, held to a form of something, but there was no real reality there. It didn't seem to make any practical difference to their life. And then I met a group of people, and it did make a practical difference. And I was intrigued that would be the case. And so, yeah, and that's what led to my series of questions.
So what happened next?
Over a period of about 6 to 9 months, through an awful lot of questions and all kinds of stuff, I slowly started coming to the conclusion that the Christian faith was probably true. I remember I was away with friends. We were camping on a mountain called Mount Olympus at the time, and I was on the top of it overlooking a big valley.
The mountain of the gods.
And I chain smoked my way through 40 cigarettes, and I can remember just thinking, I actually think this is true, but I don't want it to be. And I just thought if I became a Christian, my life would become worse. I mean, much worse. So my enjoyment of life and my fulfillment would drop, let's say, from 9 out of 10 to 1 out of 10. And I could remember thinking, why do I want to make my life worse than it is now? But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, crumbs, I think this is actually true and real, and this is my problem. And actually not believing in something which is true because you don't want it to be true isn't a good idea. So I can remember coming away from that experience on my own and going to find a few of my friends who weren't Christians and saying to them, I think I'm going to become a Christian today, and I'm telling you now because from now on I won't be enjoying myself anymore. And that's exactly how I felt. I was 100% sure that I was sacrificing on the altar of truth my only chance for happiness in this world. I was expecting to sink into some kind of emotional depression, but rather than my life collapsing and getting worse, I suddenly encountered something where I realized, crumbs, this is, why haven't I heard about this sooner? How come it's taken me this long just to get this far? And so it was a very big change, but it wasn't the result I was expecting to get.
So what difference did it make to your life, kind of immediately?
Oh, well, the very next day, I remember meeting this lady who was also a model and was one of the reasons I didn't want to become a Christian. Because although no one had said anything, I was pretty sure if I became a Christian, there'd have to be a massive revolution in my sexual ethics. And I just assumed, well, whatever plans I have there will come to an end. And I can remember walking sitting in a room into which she entered. And as soon as she saw me, she said, wow, you've changed. What happened to you? Wow. And I remember saying, I'm not sure I can explain it to you properly. And she said, well, why don't you at least try? And I said, well, so I became a Christian yesterday. And she leant forward, looked at me and said, do you want to sleep with me tonight? And I can remember looking at her saying, you know, if you'd asked me about 24 hours ago, the answer would have been yes. But today the answer's no. And the biggest surprise for me is I wasn't disappointed in my answer. And I think that's what I was expecting. I was expecting as a Christian to always feel disappointed with the answers that I was giving and the way I had to live. And all of a sudden I found not just simply that there was a way that I had to live, but that there was always now this question of who was I living for and why was I doing it? So my whole motivation began to change. So the change was really quite radical, and it affected a huge number of areas in my life. And I think one of the struggles for people who are raised in a Christian culture, maybe, is they take a lot of things for granted, and then they struggle with the sense of commitment that's required, or seems to be required within the Christian faith, all the time forgetting that all relationship relies on commitment. Whatever you're slightly committed to is going to feel shallow by comparison. And so although some commitments may seem huge, and you think, wow, what will I be missing out on? And, you know, how far does this go? When you already suddenly understand how the nature of all relationship works, which is the more you're committed to it and the more you're given to it, the more enthralling and deep it is, that equation begins to change very slightly.
You're listening to Natasha's interview with Michael Ramsden, who's a speaker and thinker with some interesting life experiences. Now, he's one of the founders of the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, among other things. And one of the many topics he's done a lot of thinking about is our culture's problem with commitment.
I mean, he's not the only one talking about this. It seems to me that lots of people are on about it at the moment. I listened to this great Harvard commencement speech that was doing the rounds on Facebook recently, where this guy called Pete Davis, I think he really nails how we, the Netflix generation, think about life.
I'm sure many of you have had this experience. It's late at night and you start browsing Netflix looking for something to watch. You scroll through different titles, you even read a few reviews, but you just can't commit to watching any given movie. Suddenly it's been 30 minutes and you're still stuck in infinite browsing mode, so you just give up. You're too tired to watch anything now, so you cut your losses and fall asleep. I've come to believe that this is the defining characteristic of our generation. Let's call it keeping our options open.
Davis talks about the concept of liquid modernity. This comes from a philosopher called Zygmunt Bauman. The idea is we don't like committing to any particular form, so we stay in a liquid state, able to adapt to anything. At the end of his talk, Davis encourages his audience, these graduating students heading out into the world, towards something that he thinks will be better.
We need not be afraid, for we have in our possession the antidote to our dread, our time, free to be dedicated to the slow but necessary work of turning visions into projects, values into practices, and strangers into neighbors. That is why, in this age of liquid modernity, we should rebel and join up with a counterculture of commitment consisting of solid people. That is why in this age of infinite browsing mode, we should pick a damn movie and see it all the way through.
I love that idea of a counterculture of commitment. Michael Ramsden struggled with the concept of commitment when he was trying to figure out whether or not he wanted to be a Christian. But he also sees this as an issue much more broadly within our culture.
I think a lot of people in our world find their experience of life, and specifically, even if they're Christian, their experience of the Christian faith, shallow. And the reason for that is we're just messing around on the surface when something far deeper has been offered to us. But all relationship is required to be like me saying, look, I want to get to know you better. But then I'm not prepared to talk to you. I never respond to your emails. I never meet up with you. I don't even greet you on the street. Well, if someone says in 5 years' time, hey, how's it going? I say, well, I'm really disappointed. You know, I really hope that this would be a more meaningful relationship. You know, the implication can be, as I'm saying that the problem's at your side. But actually, I mean, that's possible, but actually the problem's at my side, not at your side.
That we're commitment phobes across the board.
So I think generally speaking, we live in a culture, and you can understand why, because if you're committed to the wrong thing, then you give yourself wholeheartedly to it, you could end up seeing some very dangerous or damaging things take place potentially. So we think the solution is at the level of the commitment, but it's not. The process of commitment is actually very, very important. The question is, what are we ultimately committed to? That's the bigger question that we have to ask. But we struggle at every level. I remember meeting an army general a couple of years ago, and he was asking me all kinds of questions. And after 2.5 hours, I said to him, "Can I ask you a question?" I said, "You know, when I was 15 years old, so this is before I was a Christian, I said I knew what I wanted to do in life, and I was very committed to achieving it. And I was going to make a lot of money, and I was going to be very successful. I was going to do all of these things." I said, "Now my course and direction changed." I said, "But forget about being 15 now, or even 25. I meet 35-year-olds who aren't committed to anything. They just drift through. They'll try something for a while, and then they'll move on to the next thing." I said, "My question to you is, how do you breed leadership in the absence of commitment?" And the guy went very quiet, and he said, "Well, you don't know this about me, but my previous role, right up until very recently," he said, "I was in charge of officer selection and recruitment, you know, for my army, and this was our number one problem." He says, "You can't raise leadership in the absence of commitment." Just after that, I was out on the street. I got talking to somebody. I was waiting for my wife to come down. I was in London at the time. And I got talking to this guy who was buying something in front of me. And I said, "Oh, I recognize your accent. Are you from the States?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "Oh, I'm on holiday, but I'm just waiting for my wife to come out of something." And I said, "What do you do?" And he said, "Well, I'm retired, but I used to help run the LAPD. And I can remember, and I smiled and I said, "Oh, I know exactly what you do because I've watched all the movies." And at one point, I asked him the same question I asked the general. I said, "I had this conversation. I asked him this question. What would you say?" And he sat back in his chair and he said, "Wow." He says, "Well, for 5 years in my job, I was in charge of trying to raise up officer leadership." And he says, "We've flown in motivational speakers. We've flown in analysts. We've flown in all kinds of people. We spent millions of dollars and we haven't answered the question." And you can't breed leadership in the absence of commitment. So I think we live in a very interesting world, both at the relational level. A lot of people feel empty and disappointed. We look now even at a global leadership level, sometimes even on the global political stage, and we say, where are the people who are committed to something more than just themselves and actually stand for something? And then we also sometimes even look within our hearts, I say, and we just feel, even in relationship with God, even if we claim the Christian title, we think, isn't it meant to be more than this? And so the outworkings of these things are sometimes counterintuitive. Does that make sense? But the reality of them is very presently felt.
Because we kind of want to keep our options open because we don't want to miss out on anything, but actually the reverse happens. What's the
answer?
Yeah,
well, yes, and that's like everything. If you're constantly scared of, you know, you won't even pick a country to go to on holiday because you're scared of missing out on the others, then you'll end up with nothing. And so that's slightly where we are. And I think as a culture, we're scared by the nature of some commitments which are involved, but they're big. And as I say, I think for me, before I became a Christian, I can remember thinking all that matters to me is that this is true. And if it's true and it's real, then I have to respond this way. Our world's got even more complicated now because there are very few external truths and realities that we're prepared to admit to. In other words, I create my own truth and reality. And so we are literally committed to nothing but ourselves. And we wonder why we live in a world that seems to experience so much frustration and pain and anger. And that's partly the reason. We've become these very disempowered gods who stand for nothing but ourselves, all in pursuit of fulfillment, which is a very bizarre idea, empty gods.
Before I got to speak with Michael Ramsden, a colleague of mine who's worked with him before told me, "Just get him to tell you stories. He has the best stories." I was like, that's not an interview strategy. I have to actually ask him something. So one of the things I asked Michael was, what's the most unlikely crowd you've got to talk to? And how did that play out?
I have spoken to some groups. I probably may have spoken to the KGB, but not willingly. But there have been some other groups like that to whom I have spoken. I think it's hard always on a podcast to give a lot of specifics, because the very nature of a lot of the conversations I have, the reason I have them is they're kept private. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I have got to talk with various militant groups around the world. There is one in particular that I remember where I was there with a few colleagues, and the leader of a very militant group responsible for all kinds of horrible atrocities around the world came to meet. And as they came into the room, they sat down and just said, if someone believes the wrong thing, does their life have any value? And I remember as sort of saying back, well, what do you think? Which seems the safest thing when you're talking to someone who's known for terrorism. And they said, no, if you believe the wrong thing, your life has no value. Well, it helped me explain why they kill a lot of their own people as well as others. Because what they're saying is, once you've gone wrong in your mind, you've lost everything else. And so now we're trying to engage with them about, well, what does it mean to be, you know, is that the only view? And so we get to talk to some groups like that. And so I think to an external eye seems like some of the most crazy meetings that we do, maybe we're in places where our physical safety can't be assured, and we're talking to people who are known, for doing terrible things in this world. There's a part of me thinks, yeah, but in my own way, I was doing terrible things before I became a Christian. Someone was willing to talk to me, so I have to be willing to talk to you. And when you see their lives and hearts change, it's the most profound thing. They were committed to something, but the wrong thing, and they were prepared to do anything for it. But when they discover something which is right and much more noble and true, they bring that same level of commitment there. And it's amazing then to see what they go on to do, and sometimes really quite wonderful things. So, so those are the contexts that I find most interesting.
Is there one of those where you've seen someone change in that context that you could tell us about?
Yeah, there is actually. Let me put it like this. I was going to one particular country, and I did end up talking to indirectly talking to their security services. The people who met me at the airport after I landed said, oh, we were all arrested by our security services the other day because of your visit. And I can remember first thinking, it would have been nice if you told me before I landed, and maybe we could have talked about whether it was a good idea to come. And they said, they're happy you're coming. I said, what do you mean by that? And as they were being interrogated by the security services said to them, we've noticed that the people you talk to, when they become Christians, not only do they stop shooting us and blowing up us, the government, they stop shooting at other people too. And it's easier for us, therefore, for them to have this change of heart and mind. So we're not going to stop you doing what you do, which was a very, very, very interesting context to be in. And I can remember a few days after then speaking to a group of militants in a particular sort of setting who was a little bit crazy. And then afterwards, the guy who was hosting me, in order to placate them, invited them to a dinner I was speaking at the following evening, which I can remember thinking was a tragic error. And I just remember the hatred with which one of them in particular was looking at me while I was speaking. And afterwards, when I went to go and speak to them, this look of anger, which I saw on their face, just began to change. And I just went up and held up my hand and said, thank you for coming tonight. And I remember him putting his arms around me and just starting to sob, and said, listening to this Christian gospel is like watching flowers grow in a barren field. And I think we sometimes forget that sometimes some of the people who are doing some of the most painful things in this world are driven by an ideology which they're completely committed to. And what is going to change them isn't by someone from the outside standing there just yelling at them or denouncing them. But you have to be prepared to step into that world and actually model and extend something different. And if you're prepared to do that, then you're going to be heard differently, and the results potentially could be different. And so a couple of weeks' time from now, actually, I'll be back in another one of those countries meeting with a group of people who are fairly well-known around the world for some of the things they do. And I remember when I met them for the first time just last year, at the end of our 1.5-hour conversation, the leader of that group turned to the other 12 and said, this is what real love is. This is what forgiveness actually looks like. And then turned back to me and said, will you come back? And I said, sure, if you invite me, I'll come back. I'd like to spend more time with you.
You speak to a lot of people all over the world about the Christian faith. What's the strongest objection you've ever heard to your faith?
The strongest objection that I have, well, the strongest objection I ever come across is always going to be in relationship to people's personal experiences. So it's, in the end, it's not really questions of science, which I think are most people's ultimate stumbling blocks. It tends to be moral. Here's my moral complaint about this and about God, if there is a God. And very often that's wrapped up in their own personal encounter. And it's very interesting that I know there are one or two quite well-known atheists around the world who have been asked, you know, what about your personal experience of this? And they're not even willing to go there. And the fact they're not even willing to go there maybe indicates, you know, what is it? If there was nothing there, you know, there's nothing there. But if it's painful, it's hard to talk about. And I think those are the hardest things, because then we're asking the question, why me? And that requires a level of discernment that's very hard to bring. But again, that's the kind of thing, again, that comes out of time. And I think that's where, as Christians, we need to learn to be very patient. So it is difficult if you're in a public setting and someone asks a very personal question to get to the heart of that question in front of everybody else very quickly.
How do you respond to that?
Well, very often, we're sometimes the last people to be thrown out of any building that we're in. So it isn't unusual if you've spoken at 7 and finished answering questions at around 9, that at midnight you've got the janitor tapping you on the shoulder saying, we have to turn the lights out now. You need to go home. I remember being in the States, actually, speaking in one of the satellite campuses of MIT. And the place was packed to capacity. And there were various atheists and people from the secular side who come from other places to be present. And I spoke from 7 to 8. I did public Q&A from 8 to 9. And they said, can we take you out for a dinner afterwards? Well, we didn't finish until 12:30. And at 12:30, I went up to them and I said, well, look, everything's shut now and it's very late. You probably want to go home. And I remember them saying to me, if you're willing to talk, we'll stay. And we spent another 2 hours in the auditorium until 2:30 in the morning. And the opening comment that one of the guys gave was, he says, if that's the gospel, what I've just heard, then you need to go to every city in North America and you need to speak it as loudly as you possibly can, and you need to start with the church. And I think that what also makes this complicated, most people's understanding of the Christian faith is a misunderstanding, and you have to try to correct it first.
So what then is the strongest argument for the Christian faith?
Well, I think there are two, and which are sort of related, and I think they can be seen, misunderstood, to be the weakest. If God is a person, then, and is personal, then there are two things about him which are correct, just like two things about you. You objectively exist even if I don't want you to. So if I decide I don't believe in you anymore and I don't want you to exist, that doesn't stop you existing. But it also means if I'm incurious and I want to meet you, that makes sense, that's possible through a subjective encounter, which is rooted in my experience. And I think what sometimes people forget about God is that what we're saying is two things. One, even if you didn't want him to exist, which is the situation I was in, here are all the good reasons. And actually, I think there are a few of those. But we sometimes then forget the second one, which is, and you can meet him as well. That's actually possible. So therefore, holding those two things together is therefore very important, which is why we can welcome very difficult questions. Because it's not just about, hey, this is what I think. It's, well, regardless of what I wanted to think, is this actually the case? But then there's this flip side too, which is, and this isn't some kind of abstract idea I've committed myself to. This is now also a real person who I've encountered. You separate those two things out, you're always going to have a bit of a problem. And so I think the strongest case is when you see those two things joined together.
That was Michael Ramsden talking with Natasha about some of the people he's come across and the cultural trends he's noticed as he travels the world, speaking about, well, life and faith.
We talked about a bunch of other stuff too. Mostly we had a big conversation about justice and forgiveness and a thing called victim culture, which is not at all what I thought it was. We've got that coming up next week on the podcast, so do subscribe, download it when it's out, and share this episode with someone you think would enjoy it. Here's a quick preview from part 2 of my interview with Michael.
There's a very interesting phrase in the Old Testament where it says, you've turned justice into bitterness, so your righteous acts taste like poison fruit. If your motivation for justice is bitterness, even if you get that which is right, it can taste like poison to everybody else. But if what drives our quest for justice in this world is love and compassion, when you get justice, you're left with love and compassion.